Hi, everybody. Continuing my tradition of having unbelievable guests on my show today, I've got Dr. Drew Pinsky, who's here to chat with me about all sorts of really cool things. How are you doing, Drew?
I am good. It's such a privilege to be here. I could chat with you. This could go on for quite some time if we don't stop to it. But be that as it may, how am I doing? I'd say I'm 98%. I still got bad ringing in my ear from my long COVID, or what we call now post-acute sequelae COVID, PASC, according to Dr. Fauci. And but my stamina and stuff is sort of returning. I had a weird day yesterday, but I'm mostly back. Mostly back.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it. Let me just do a little intro of who you are for the 7 or 8 people who don't know who you are. So you're a physician who specializes in internal medicine and in treatment of addiction. You're basically everywhere. There's nowhere where we don't find you. You're on podcasts such as Dr. Drew After Dark, The Adam and Drew Show. You also have live streaming shows such as Ask Dr. Drew and Dose of Dr. Drew. You're a contributor on Fox LA.
Which
Sorry?
you have kindly appeared on, which we appreciate very, very
Well,
much.
aren't you sweet? You're a contributor on Fox LA with Alex Michelson, a regular host on MTV's Teen Mom. You're a regular on Dr. Oz Show. And I didn't know this last bit. You were the eagle on The Masked Singer on Fox. How did that go, by the way?
That was me having a little extra time. And let me just say, when I was a kid, I sung opera. And I saw the sign for that show, the first season. I thought I should be on that show. And so I talked to some people and I was like, yeah, put me on that. It'd be funny. It'd be interesting. And I know Ken Jeong and Jenny McCarthy very, very well. And I thought this will screw with them and this will be fun. And it really was. So, best produced per show on television. My God, the things they have to manage. But it
Here,
was fun and it was an education. It was really interesting.
here's an interesting question since you mentioned Jenny McCarthy. So one of the official endorsers of my book, The Parasitic Mind, is Paul Offit, who was the bête noire of Jenny McCarthy, because Paul is a infectious disease specialist who was sort of the poster, individual fighting against the anti-vaxxers. And of course, Jenny McCarthy was on the other side of that debate. Did any of these issues ever come up between you and her, given that you're obviously a physician?
No, she and I have been friends. We were both on MTV back in the 90s, and that was before, well before she started talking about these things. And we and I have a deep affection for Jenny, and so we just avoid these things. We just avoid them and that's that. And we do great. She's a smart person. She's not the only person that has these opinions. Just she has a big megaphone. And
Has she ever, do you know if she's revised any of her positions, or has she been doggedly dogmatic in her defense?
I think, she has a young son with autistic spectrum, and I think she has learned a lot about that disorder and the complexities of it. And I think that has softened her. That my sense is that has softened her position.
Got you. Okay, so let's begin first with COVID. I know you're not an infectious disease specialist, but you're certainly a practicing physician. What's your view?
And a patient.
And
So I have both
now,
perspectives.
when did you contract it? When did this happen?
Christmas Eve.
Oh, how long did the whole thing last before you felt
I
like?
was really in bed for 3 weeks. I mean, it was bad. I had the full. I was heading towards hospitalization, and it was only high dose Decadron and a monoclonal antibody, bamlanivimab, that kept me out. I had a striking response to the monoclonal antibody, and that's when I sort of stabilized. And then after 3 weeks in bed, I was the next 3 weeks sort of kind of getting out of bed. So 6 weeks of really sick. And then the next 4 weeks with, ringing in the ears and fatigue. If back 3 weeks ago, if I'd had this conversation with you, I'd have to go lay down for 2 hours afterwards.
Wow. Now, I did mention you, I did see that you mentioned at one point in one of your tweets, we follow each other on Twitter, that you suffer from tinnitus. Now,
Terrible.
is the tinnitus in any way, what the onset of tinnitus was due to COVID, or this is a completely different issue?
This is COVID. It was night of day two with fever. I had a very strange. I was negative on PCR first 4 days of illness, and by the night of the coming into the fourth day, I started lying in bed thinking like a doctor, going, "Oh, this is better. Oh man, if I'm negative today, I have acute lymphocytic leukemia. There's no doubt in my mind. That's what this is. This is ALL. So I better be prepared in the morning. I'm gonna have a bone marrow biopsy and blah blah blah." I was like all preparing myself for a leukemia diagnosis because that's in my age group. That's what does these, horrible prostration with terrible fevers and stuff. Thankfully, my PCR came back positive. I tweeted, I'm hoping for a positive PCR. Of course, I'm destroyed by Twitter. Like, how dare you think about a positive? You're wishing for a positive PCR. Hey, dummies, think a little deeper. So day two, night two, I was awake in the middle of the night with extraordinary tinnitus. It was like a buzzing. It was nothing I'd ever really experienced before. And by morning, it went from this low-pitched, loud buzzing to the high-pitched tinnitus that we're all accustomed to when we've ever had it from singing, you know, loud music or whatever. And now it's all the time. And it kind of waxes and wanes down. It's just in my right ear. So, you know, we know that there's microvascular damage of the olfactory nerve. That's what causes the lack of sense of smell. And it also hits the 12th cranial nerve, right? It hits the tongue. So it's 1 and 12. Makes sense to me it might hit 8 as well, which is the ear. So either I have some microvascular injury to the 8th cranial nerve or something happened in my temporal lobe. I will tell you that the long hauler syndrome, the symptoms past week 3 really felt like a traumatic brain injury. That's what I imagine, you know, traumatic brain injuries feel like. You're just out of it. You can't follow sequences. Your sleep is disrupted. You're depressed. You're fatigued by everything. It's very, very interesting syndrome.
I'm not sure I'm happy to hear all this because we're currently in my own home under a internal lockdown because one of my children was exposed and that she was in the same class as three people who came down with COVID. So I haven't been able to hug her or kiss her for about 8 days. I think the final test will be March 9th. She's already gotten 2 negatives. Right. Do you think we're clear or should we still be worried?
You're not clear, but you're good. You're not clear. Hey, the one other thing you should know, I took a medicine called fluvoxamine about 3 weeks ago, and it markedly helped my long hauler syndrome. There is a sigma-1 anti-inflammatory system in the brain that the Luvox or fluvoxamine activates, and there's some evidence that taking it even earlier in the illness can really have a significant effect. And it was a non-issue. I had no side effects. I wasn't even aware I was taking it, except that I had more energy and the ringing in my ears went away or got better.
And how right now on a scale of 0 is the worst, 100 it's the best. What's your score in terms of how you feel?
98. I'm 98 most of the time.
Oh, good. Okay.
So maybe I'd send a 92 or something once in a while, but I'm back. I'm all back.
Oh, very good. All right. So what are your thoughts about I think the main issue that people would certainly like to hear about is how do physicians feel about the lockdown? Of course, you've got some that want to keep us in lockdown forever until there is eradication of every known pathogen in the history of humanity, and others who say this is insane. There are all sorts of other downstream effects. Where do you fall on that debate?
I'm in the skeptical center, I would say, in that I was doing daily streams and a daily television show addressing what was happening locally, particularly in response to COVID. And so I sat here as this whole thing evolved. By the way, I still have a little word-finding difficulty left over from the COVID. And I originally got in trouble because I was pushing back very hard on the panic horn 1 year ago. 1 year ago, I saw the press using words like staggering and grim and, you know, just these incredible words that were gonna hurt people. I knew it was gonna cause a panic, and the panic could not be good no matter what the situation was. And I kept saying, this whatever happened in Wuhan, trust the medical system, listen to Dr. Fauci, follow what the CDC tells you. I just kept saying that. Don't listen to the press. Don't listen to the government. This should be managed by the medical professionals. Let's hear what they have to say. Don't panic. The press needs to – I kept saying press needs to shut up, to shut up talking about it. And in retrospect, I was watching the policies of the Chinese communist government and saying to myself, well, that what they're doing there does not exist in any infectious disease textbooks or epidemiology textbooks. They're doing something that has never been done before, has never worked because, you know, whenever it's done even locally, it doesn't work. So I don't know what they're doing. And in my instinct, I thought, are they hiding something? Because they're going so hard at it. Maybe they're trying to hide something because that's the only thing that explains what they're doing. And then as it came here, I watched as we then demanded the same policies. And I was confused. But I shut up at that point. And that was at the point Dr. Fauci said, this is not the flu. This is not like H1N1. This is like something different. I adjusted my priors. I was wrong thinking it was like a bad flu. It's different than that. It is different. It's a false comparison to push it up against influenza or H1N1. And I adjusted my priors, apologized for getting things wrong, and kept learning just like the rest of us about what this thing is and what we need to do to it. But I was due for it. But I remember sitting there when Governor Newsom here in California shut the whole state down, and I thought, well, that is excessive. But as a good citizen, I'm going to support him because we really don't know. There's a lot of unknowns here. So I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going to support his decision. He's preparing for the worst. He's bringing in a Navy hospital ship. Okay. I guess if I were in his position, preparing for the worst is an okay thing. I'm going to support this guy. And then fast forward 3 days, somebody from the school board came onto our program and said, we're shutting the school down. And literally I sat there and I said, and on television, I said, did a doctor make this decision? Did somebody in the CDC tell you to do this? What are you doing? We think it's the right thing to do. All right. So there we were. That was my position. I was a willing citizen, a good soldier. And as this thing dragged on, it became increasingly clear that these were, I don't want to call them bad policies, but excessive. And they were not based on a good risk-reward analysis. And the consequences were clearly accumulating and going to be awful, awful in terms of mental health consequences, drug overdoses. We hit 90,000 in this country already this year. I don't mean in 2021. I mean in the last 12 months. Suicide up. Distress in the 8 to 15-year-old population is through the roof. Social phobia now is massively increasing in young people because why? They're supposed to be developing their social skills. We give them no opportunity to that. And we tell them, every person is going to kill your grandmother. Stay away. So I can't imagine a better recipe for social phobias, social anxiety disorders. So anxiety disorder, I talked to a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist. I was thinking about this this morning. She sees a lot of young, adolescents and children and in this across the spectrum socioeconomically. And I say, what are you seeing? She goes, anxiety, depression. I go, yeah, that's what we've done. That's what we've done to young people. Good job. Well done. And then no pulling back from these policies that seem excessive. I don't blame them. Look, we were all learning. We were all guessing lots of bad moves were made. But the inability to adjust course to me is just astonishing.
Right.
That's the part I'm back to shaking my head about. I think when we look back on this, school closure will look to be the most serious misadventure of the entire affair.
I mean, we've been fortunate in where I live in Montreal in that our children have had access to in-person education from the start.
Look, pretty much all countries, the worst I can find out there is a two-month closure in certain parts of Europe. Nobody closed down for a year and a half like we did. And now we're fighting teachers' unions who don't want to go back to school to work.
Yeah, of course.
Astonishing. Of course, you say. I'm astonished.
You mentioned Dr. Fauci. Now, I'm looking at this from the outside. I don't know him. I've never interacted with him. I get that, but certainly as a psychologist and as a behavioral scientist, you'll get the gist of my question. I feel as though Dr. Fauci is really, really lacking on epistemic humility in that he now, you might argue that many physicians lack the module in their brain where epistemic humility is triggered. But it seems to me that Fauci kind of revels, and I understand that I don't know if you know him or not, and I understand you want to be diplomatic.
Well, this is a great question. Revels in what?
Well, he revels in, first, the attention, and there is no feedback loop in him where he says, you know what, let me be careful here in not saying this or saying that. I understand that most people were flying blind when we started, but, to have an official medical person for every single possible event, first say it's A, then say it's not A, I start to lose patience with you, right? When you say, you don't need to wear a mask. No, you need to wear a mask. No, it's not transmitted from person to person. Yes, so what are you a specialist of in terms of infectious diseases if these basic issues, I'm not asking you to tell me the molecular structure of COVID. I'm simply asking you whether I should wear a mask or not, whether it is transmitted from human to human or not. Both of these, he got completely wrong. Okay, then he corrected. Do you get the sense that there is a bit of epistemological arrogance on his part?
I think that he is a political animal, having been in the government for so long, and I don't believe he's epistemologically I think he's cautious epistemologically, but I don't think he will show it.
Okay.
He's been in these leadership positions in government for so long, he shows one face only. And I've been working around and behind – I've been standing behind him since the AIDS epidemic. That's where I got to know him, because I was very active in the AIDS epidemic. And it's he that got me to go on the radio. In 1984, he was saying, pounding that us young physicians have got to get out there and educate and change behaviors and get on media and educate about this. And the word wasn't getting out. I took that very seriously. And when I had an opportunity to go on the radio, I thought, oh, here we go. No one's talking to these young people about HIV.
Oh, you froze. Hello? Are you there?
And, that
sorry, Drew.
That was him pushing.
Drew, hold on. You completely froze for about a minute. I need you to go back to when he was trying to get young physicians to go into the field. So, could you repeat from there, please?
So I was working deep into the AIDS epidemic in the early, the mid-80s, and he was my North Star. I advocated he should be everyone's North Star in the COVID epidemic as well. And as such, he was urging young physicians to get out there and educate and change behavior, because it just wasn't being communicated, particularly to young people. I took that very seriously. When I had an opportunity to go on the radio, that motivated me. And, we weren't even calling it HIV yet. It was HTLV and then HTLV3, and we just stopped calling it GRIDS, and the term safe sex hadn't been coined yet. But what I know about him is he is extraordinarily consistent, but the face that he shows is very conservative. He will never speculate beyond wouldn't say worst case scenarios, but likely bad outcomes. Right. He presents that, because I remember in the AIDS epidemic, he said there's going to be 2 million dead, 2 million dead, unless under his breath to us, he'd say publicly, he'd say 2 million people are going to die. And then to us would say, unless we get out there and educate, and really do the right thing, then we can get this thing down. So that's kind of the way he operates.
Gotcha. All right. I was going to ask next about all your addiction work. But before I do that, since we're talking about different specialties in medicine, infectious disease, and so on, and as somebody who studies decision making, what is it that caused you, out of the whole buffet of possible specialties that you could have gone into, why did you choose the particular one that you did? What was your mechanism?
Yeah. So I've seen my peers use lots of different mechanisms. Some of them are mysterious to me. A lot of it sometimes is they had a thing in their head of what they wanted to be. Sometimes it's they want to make money. Sometimes they like the peer group, which is always that was a surprising one to me. A friend of mine who became a urologist said, I loved urologists. They seemed like nice guys. So I went with them. You know, for me, I loved medical training. It was one of the most, up to that point in my life, it was one of the most thrilling things I had done. And so every rotation except pediatrics, broke my heart. I just couldn't do it. Except pediatrics, every rotation, I wanted to be that. I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. I wanted to be a gynecologist. I wanted to be a general. Every rotation, I thought, this is it. And by, eight rotations in, I was starting to get confused. Like, I want to do all these things. I got to make a choice. And the last rotation I did in my third year was general medicine. And within 2 days, I thought, oh, right. This is why I wanted to become a doctor, to do this, to be at the center of everything, but, sort of able to do the general aspects of healthcare and to be able to interact with grandma and everybody. Family medicine wasn't quite for me because I kind of wanted to be an expert, but the general internal medicine hit the spot. And that was it. It was like the clouds opened up and I thought, oh, I know what I'm doing now.
Very nice. Now, so next question is, there's a great study that I actually cite in The Parasitic Mind where researchers had looked at the political affiliation of physicians based on their specialties.
Oh, right? That's interesting.
Yeah, isn't that cool? And so I'm just going to give you the main ones at the two ends of the continuum and then, just ask you to weigh in on this. So
When was this? That's another important point.
I'm going to guess. I mean, I'll pull out the reference for you and I'll send it to you privately, but I'm going to say about 3, 4, 5 years ago, something to that effect.
Well, relatively modern history.
Right, exactly. So there were 24 medical specialties listed. Surgeons and anesthesiologists were the most Republican, In the sort of two-thirds and more category.
Yep.
And psychiatrists, and the reason why I thought about this question, because I knew we were going to talk about COVID, psychiatrists and infectious disease specialists were by far the most ultra, super blue, progressive liberals.
Interesting.
So what are your thoughts? How do you explain it? Do you have any on-the-spot, you know, ideas?
Well, the infectious disease part, I know what that is. That is a – because a big part of what motivates someone to go into infectious diseases is the public health.
Community.
Yeah, the public health. And lots of my infectious disease colleagues go to extraordinarily underserved environments to study infectious disease. They go into Africa and they go places where that's where the infectious diseases are, in these populations that are deeply underserved. And so that makes sense to me, that would be something they would go for. Psychiatry historically has been that way.
Well, let me propose to you my hypothesis for why psychiatry.
I want to first say something inflammatory.
Okay, go.
Is that how am I going to say this without getting myself in trouble? So, I know you like stuff like this, so that's why I'm going to stop you and put
Speak
it.
Speak from
there.
The heart. Go.
The reason we have homelessness is because of three asshole psychiatrists that fashion themselves to be social engineers that believe they knew more than anybody about what humanity needed. They formed and headed up the National Institute of Mental Health for 40 years, these three guys. And they literally took the position that psychoanalysts, not just psychiatrists, because they were all psychoanalytically trained, that the psychoanalyst is the best positioned human to solve humanity's problems. And therefore, they were going to solve them. They were narcissistic, grandiose, pathological persons who, just because they were psychoanalysts, and by the way, one of them was like an entomologist by training, and the other was like, I mean, they came out of disciplines that weren't even medicine, but they became doctors, but very quickly went into psychoanalysis. They were, I don't know that they were a bad human beings, but they were the wrong people at that time. They dismantled the state healthcare system, which had problems, but they dismantled it completely. A system that had taken 150 years to be developed, they vaporized it and did not put anything sane in its place. What they put in its place was community centers to prevent mental illness, something we don't know how to do to this day. And the result was people left the state hospitals, prisons, streets, nursing homes. That's where they ended up. And now they're not going to the prisons, they're just in the streets. And welcome to the current problem in this country.
For historical completeness, can we name the three psychiatrists?
One guy was named Brown, the other guy, I have a whole lecture on this, and I'm pushing their names out of my, it was the first three heads of the National Institute of Mental Health.
So, you could send me the...
Well-meaning assholes.
Yeah. So here's my theory as to why I think a lot of psychiatrists, I mean, it kind of jives with what you're saying. A lot of the early psychiatry was very much rooted in an environmental etiology, right? I mean, schizophrenia was not due to an organic disease. It was due because mom that hugged you too much or didn't hug you enough. So if you come from a social constructivist tabula rasa perspective, then it would only make sense that that would, you know, factor analyze, if you'd like, with the leftist agenda, right? Because the leftists are the ones typically who are engaging in social engineering and utopia and so on. So it makes sense to me. But how do you explain why anesthesiologists and surgeons are not bitten by the progressive bug? Do you have any ideas for that one?
Well, I do. I would only say that group in the surgical suite, they tend to be individualists.
Yeah,
they tend to be autonomous. They tend to, and it's really interesting. I saw this writ large during the COVID epidemic. One of the things that I learned from the COVID epidemic is that medicine has become ossified because most general physicians now and ER doctors work for corporations or large hospitals. And during this epidemic, physicians are used to using their judgment and improvising and doing the best we can based on our clinical information. The science usually catches up with that in an emergency. We don't wait for the science and then try to save a life. We do the best we can given our judgment. they were frozen solid and unwilling to do anything other than an orthodoxy handed down from above. I've never seen that in my entire career. And it literally made me think, well, why do we even need physicians then? If we can't use our judgment and can't improvise in dramatic situations, then fine, have nurse practitioners and physician assistants just follow a clinical pathway. We don't need doctors anymore, which is the direction they're heading. By contrast, every surgeon I know was keen to try all kinds of things for their patients, for their family, for themselves when they got exposed or when they got sick. I saw them doing all kinds of stuff on the DL, and guess what? It worked. It worked for their family.
Right.
But they were kind of calling me on the DL and asking for advice and doing things. They were highly improvisational because if something goes wrong when you open somebody up, you don't wait for an orthodoxy to be handed down. You decision make, you improvise, and you solve the problem when the bleeder starts, when in the surgical arena. So they're very accustomed to doing that.
How do you so one of my biggest, I think, personal weaknesses in my, you know, daily, if not yearly life, is when I have to muster up my courage to go for my, you know, physical, to make sure that everything is well. And I'm convinced that every single time I'm going to go, I'm going to hear some dreadful news. And I'm literally frozen in fear. So much so, and I'm not a hypochondriac. In other words, I don't go to see my physician because I think I have this when I don't really. But I'm so fearful of any interaction with the medical system, perhaps because I have such an unbelievable, you know, effusive love for life that I don't want the party to end, that I don't want to, that I never can understand how a physician can be navigating all day in hell, right? In disease and death and bad news, and not internalize it. How did you do it? Because I think I would commit suicide within probably 24 hours of becoming a physician.
It's sort of like, I equate it with like what an ambulance driver or a paramedic must experience, which is, those people are sort of mystery to me too, because out in the field, it's like out of control. And that, to me, once they get to me, I've got a controlled environment, I have resources, I have technologies, I can do stuff. And that's my point. You have a job to do, you do the best you can. And death and dying becomes a very real part of life. And by the way, if you've actually done the best you can, that's the best you can do. And the idea of disease and dying can be, this may be too strong a word, it certainly becomes a part of life, and it can be sort of celebrated as a part of life. In other words, it's such a distinct reality for me. When I was working 20 hours a day, death was at least twice a day affair. I mean, it was constant. And being able to incorporate that into the narrative of life and understand it deeply and to see it in all its permutations, that's kind of glorious. And when I'm lucky enough to help people have a dignified and a celebratory end after a long life, that's good. Right. I'm happy for that. And that's more often than not the situation I'm in.
Well, hats off to you for doing it, because I certainly couldn't. At one point, I thought about whether I was interested in going into medicine. I just thought I just didn't have the right personality for it.
You could always do dermatology or ophthalmology.
Well, melanoma, that seems pretty serious.
Yeah, listen, when I first started doing medicine, I thought, oh, when everyone else is done with them and it's time to die, they send them to the internist because everybody else wants to fix until they can't do anything. Then they're like, okay, go see your doctor. And that was happening a lot. And I was like, wow, we're the ones that have to deal with this end of life stuff and the family and everything that follows. And I got pretty good at it. And so, I got to accept it. And then, you know, I had this very extraordinary experience. I have an experience in medicine that I don't see. I just am not coming across other physicians that have had this experience that I had. I was working 20-hour days for 15 years, and half the day was in a hospital or in a medical clinic, and the other half was in a psychiatric hospital. And so I got to see the full spectrum of the human experience in a way that very few people do. That psychiatric piece, I thought I understood that when I started working at the psychiatric hospital. Oh, no, I did not. And now, having worked there for 25 years, I know enough to call a psychiatrist to make the decisions, because they have specialized training that I do not. I understand what's going on now, but I want them to make that decision. Because, look, you go to a doctor not for their fund of knowledge. You go to them, that physician, for their decision-making, That's why you go. Their judgment. Because you have the he or she has seen whatever you're coming in with many, 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 many times, maybe hundreds of times. What you want is the right call for you. Right. You want somebody to apply great judgment. And people don't understand that. They think it's about knowledge, or, you know, because they're just coming across it on their Google searches. We've been working with You Just Google Search for decades and seeing it in all its manifestations in a clinical setting.
Well, you just mentioned psychiatry, which is a great segue for my next set of questions dealing with addiction. But let me set it up for a second, okay? So in my own work, in two of my earlier books, I have chapters where I look at the evolutionary roots of dark side consumption. And so let me give you an example of a dark side consumatory act: pathological gambling, eating disorders, pornographic addictions, excessive risk-taking, things that when you engage with them result in deleterious consequences. But I try to look at the underpinnings, right? Why do you engage in these maladaptive behaviors if you're supposed to be this ultra-adaptive creature, right? And so in doing so, I contextualize what I was doing vis-a-vis the traditional social science model, which argues that everything is due to social construction. It's right. So in psychiatry, psychoanalysis was it's all due to the schizophrenic mother, right?
Yes.
So if we now apply the tension between, so in psychiatry, it's either heavy pharmacological approach versus heavy environmental approach, where of course the correct answer is somewhere in the middle. In the addiction field, where are we in terms of assigning weight? And I understand it varies depending on which addiction you're talking about, but in terms of assigning an etiology to nature versus nurture. And before you answer, an example of nurture would be, it's because you've had childhood trauma that resulted in you now becoming a meth addict, right? Nature would be, look, there are simply physiological mechanisms that if you take this drug, it will trigger your pleasure center, and you go down an infinite loop of seeking that pleasure. So right. Where are we in the addiction story in terms of this debate?
Let's define, again, the terminology is all over the place, right? Because the DSM-5 now has substance use disorder. You're not allowed to use the word addiction and all this craziness. Let me just, I like to think very simply. Addiction is a syndrome. Essentially, well, it's like all illnesses, it's a complex relationship between the genetics and the environment, right? That result in pathophysiology. The pathophysiology is reflected in signs and symptoms. The signs and symptoms follow a predictable pattern we call a natural history, and we can alter that natural history with something called treatment. That's addiction. That's disease, and that's what addiction is. So addiction is progressive use in the face of consequence: work, school, finance, health, relationships. And in my experience, denial is always a big feature of that, but that's a sort of separate topic. But so I distinguish between addiction and dependency. So dependency can look like addiction when somebody's using, but when you take them off, they don't want to keep going. Oh, good, I'm never going to do that again, and that's the end of it. They were strung out on it. They can have some behavioral disturbances, but they don't keep going back. An addict, as I'm again using that word in non-PC way, my patients go back. They always go back. And you got to remember, the brain has two systems: a liking and a wanting system. My addict patients go back even when they don't like it anymore. They just want. The wanting system is what's broken. The do it again system is what's broken. And it appears that there's a heavy genetic component to that wanting system getting inflamed like that. Now, it's not one gene, and it's not a switch. It's a spectrum disorder, right? Some people, they get exposed to a little bit of something and it's on. Some people, they have to be exposed for a while and then it's on. It's the losing control piece of the wanting system that appears to be a specific biology that doesn't happen to everybody. I always say I treated about 10,000 addicts in my career running a treatment center. I can only think of five where I couldn't see a clear genetic link, clear, obvious family history. And the issue then of the environment, that genes are not destiny. Genes are essentially never destiny. Tay-Sachs disease, I guess, is destiny, right? You know, there's some destinies, but essentially genes have to be, it's a gene-environment interaction always.
Exactly.
So you can have the genetics and never get this thing. No problem. But in my world, if you have bad enough addiction that it's triggered to the extent that you need to see me, I only saw the worst. When everyone else was done, that's when I got them. There was 100% probability of childhood trauma in my patients. I was talking to a friend of mine. I said, my patients always have childhood trauma. And he goes, oh, don't ever say that. Don't say always. I go, okay, 100% of the time.
But hold on. Before you go on, give me a specific definition of what would constitute childhood trauma. Because, you know, me losing 7 games, and I'm not trying to be facetious, right? I could fit anything you want on the... Now, listen, I grew up in the Lebanese Civil War. Now, it's almost difficult to imagine something more traumatic than that, right? I mean, the things that... Right? Yet... I would not place the blame on why I ended up putting on a lot of excess weight due to my Lebanese childhood. In other words, it's a way out. How about personal response?
I'm talking about something different. Okay, I'm talking about interpersonal trauma, typically at the hands of the people who are supposed to be the source of safety, security, and love.
So parents.
Parents. Typically, it was being physically abused with... I'd have to extract this from the patient. I always go, were you ever physically abused? No. Were you disciplined? Well, sure, I was disciplined like everybody. Okay, so your patient hit you? Yeah, they hit mom, hit me all the time. I go, okay. Did she ever pick up an object? An axe and a baseball bat, but, you know, that's about it. Just, you know, so I would hear that all day long. So lots of physical abuse, lots. Often abandonment and neglect, which was another big feature. And then sexual abuse was rampant. Now, that wasn't typically it was sometimes by the family members, but more typically by neighbors and people nearby, in kids who already had something else going on that sort of made them good victims, typically abandonment. So as I saw, lots of abandonment, lots of neglect, lots of sexual abuse, and lots of physical abuse. So my patients were hitting adolescents unregulated. They were unable to regulate their emotions. Emotions were too long, too prolonged, too intense, too negative. And they'll tell you that drugs saved their lives. It made it possible for them to regulate, possible for them to. So because they had no internal resources to regulate, they were reaching outside of their body to regulate their emotions. And then they triggered this thing that I call addiction. It caused me, you know, having dealt with this for so many years, to do a deep study of how is it the human being normally develops the capacity for flexible emotional regulation, right? That's what this begs the issue of. And I'm deep in the school of Peter Fonagy and Alan Shore and these guys who have built theoretical models on how this goes down. And I have applied them clinically and they work. So, you know, if you study that stuff, there's some reason to believe it might have some utility.
But so let's take an example where I know for sure that there isn't any abuse of the kinds that you mentioned. Yeah. I am an 18-year-old who's at a party. I tend to be conformist, so I don't have a strong sense of self to say no to drugs, as Nancy Reagan wanted us to all do.
I'm going to interrupt you. Be careful. I said if you have bad enough addiction that you need to see me, there's all kinds of other addictions out there. You know what I'm saying? If it's bad enough that I see you,
then all the things you said make sense. Yes, but I'm trying to sort of contextualize how much of the problem stems from forces that were out of your control, so that the addictive source ends up being something that I use to medicate myself out of my ugly reality, versus just the accidental physiological traps that I fall into because I tried once at a party crystal meth. And it was so addictive. There is really nothing in my childhood that suggested that I should ever want this. I just fell into a trap. How often does that happen?
A lot. Happens to truck drivers all the time, right? They're just trying to stay up at night, and all of a sudden they happen to have this potential, and boom, it gets triggered. I will tell you the one hallmark for those people, and some of them will say it out loud and then say, that's why I didn't do any more of that. There's a hallmark experience that people will describe when there's real addictive potential, and they will say the following: I loved it. They will always use the word love. Like, it is so powerful. It's so nurturing. It's anterior cingulate. It's really the activation of the opioid centers in the anterior cingulate, where literally mom is evoked. I loved it. Like, and some people go, and from that day forth, that was my thing. And others go, and that's why I knew I should never touch it again. Now, what determines one from the other is a really interesting question.
Wow. Would it surprise you if I told you I have never tried a single drug in my entire... I haven't even taken a puff of a cigarette. How do we explain that? Alcohol. You know how I first had alcohol? I was a 23-year-old competitive soccer player. When the captain of my team found out that I had never drank, I used to have long hair. A whole bunch of the players, you know, scooped on me, took a pair of scissors, and said, "Either you drink or you lose your Samsonian hair." And I drank. 23 years old. So how do you explain? Am I just a goody two-shoes? How do you explain the fact that I've never had the allure to try any of this stuff?
We'd have to sit and chat for a lot longer than this, I think, for me to get to the bottom of that. But I will tell you again, because I told you I had this extraordinary clinical experience where I just saw stuff that, you know, other physicians didn't get to see. I saw this. And more often than not, when I saw this behavior, of course, mind you, I had a selected population. It was often family members of somebody I was treating who would tell me something like this. And it's often a parent with alcoholism. That was often the background. Some parent who was doing some stuff and he went, "I don't want anything to do with that," and never touched it. That's, again, not exclusively what causes this, but that was a common thing I came across.
I want to link, so my next question, still on addiction, but linking it to our conversation on your show of a few weeks ago where we really delved into, you know, evolutionary thinking. Yeah. So there is...
Oh, I got a great theory for you.
Yeah, hold on. So before you go on. So, you know, I think we discussed last time the difference between proximate and ultimate explanations. Proximate, the how and what. Ultimate is the Darwinian why. I'm almost certain that every addiction specialist is going to operate in proximate world. You, as someone who is a very committed, evolutionary thinker, do you apply ultimate evolutionary world in your thinking in treating patients with addiction?
Of course. I'm a biologist. I can't help it. I can't help it. So here's what I came across early in my career. I was thinking, God, why does this disease causes so much pathology and disease and destruction? How could it persist in the human genome for so long? It's just 10%. It's always there. It never changes. How did this not burn out of the human genome since we developed distilled spirits, which is when you started really seeing this stuff evolve? And again, you can map it to the Mediterranean environment where they developed distilled spirits. And yet the genetics persist. And so I started thinking, God, it must have some adaptive advantage. It must be something. Then... these are the series of events. This is a long time ago that led to me thinking about this. I was in a symposium, addiction medicine symposium, and there were some lectures on the genetics. We were starting to isolate the genes. And somebody said, you know, maybe we could do in utero testing and abort the fetuses with this gene. And I thought, whoa, that is like, woo, this is outer space talk now. And then I thought, those are my patients. You want them not to exist? And then I started thinking about the patients. I'm like, they're smart. They're rich. I love working with them. They're a very human population with all kinds of, I mean, they're a very rich resource population internally. They bring so much to life. And I thought, wow, I wouldn't want to get rid of that. They behave like assholes when they're addicts. Don't get me wrong. But there's a lot of stuff that they had that I could appreciate. And it's one of the reasons I enjoyed restoring them to life, because there it came back, you know. Fast forward about 2 weeks, I'm watching the movie Braveheart. And in there, they portray very clearly that 10,000 Scotsmen go into battle, 10 survive, clearly the alcoholics. Clearly the alcoholics. And I thought, oh, that's interesting that they have a point here. So I went back. I was giving lectures to large groups of addicts every week. And so I went back to the audience and I said, you know, what would happen to you guys if a bunch of Huns came over the hill right now? And because in my mind, I'm thinking I would run and hide. And they all, to a person, they would just go, I grab something, I'd run right at them. I'm like, are you really would do that? I go, well, how about a bomb went off in the parking lot? I'd go right into the bomb pit. I want to see what's going on. I thought, oh, there, that's different. That's a different biology.
The evolutionary roots of liquid courage.
Well, evidently, if I'm in a battle with a bunch of Huns, running and getting a spear in my back is less likely to survive than grabbing a sword and going at it, right? And so I started looking around the world, and where you find the incidence of alcoholism the highest, it's in isolated populations, which is a perfect evolutionary sort of laboratory, that have generational military assaults. Highland Scotland, North American Indians, certain parts of Central Europe, multiple generations of military style stressors. And I found out subsequently that parts of the military will seek out non-using addicts and alcoholics for fighter pilots and things because, and I would ask the patients, I go, what happens if you were on behind a plane and, you know, a couple of Russian MiGs would come after you? Oh, that'd be awesome. They make great shortstops. They make great extreme athletes. Everything slows down for them, and they're at their best when they're in extreme circumstances.
That was, by the way, fascinating. I'd love if the stuff about the military, the links between military societies and addiction or alcohol, if you could send me the link to that, I would love to share that with my audience.
And narcissism too, apparently.
Beautiful.
It was a friend of mine who used to work for the military. I had an old-time psychoanalyst I used to work alongside of back in the early part of the 2000s. He was the one that told me that. So I don't have an actual resource. Okay. They said they used to send him in. He used to go in to make sure they weren't so narcissistic or so prone to using that they would spin out, that they could really rely on them to stay within the military discipline.
Very nice. Well, along the same lines, I reviewed a paper a few years ago. I used to be the associate editor of a journal called Evolutionary Psychology. And I had reviewed a paper that looked at binge drinking as a costly signal. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with do you know what Zahavian signaling is? So Zahavian signaling is the following concept from evolutionary biology. So if you look at the tail of the peacock,
I do know what that is.
Right.
Yeah.
So it couldn't have. So let me just mention it for the audience.
It's why young males go climb trees and beat them.
Exactly.
It's why we have jackass movies and things like that.
Exactly, because for a signal to be honest that others can't mimic, it has to be handicapping. It has to be costly. Otherwise, we could all imitate it. If all it takes to impress the ladies is to do 10 push-ups, that both you and I will meet that standard. But if we need to jump off a cliff that's 100 foot high, then we will quickly assort between the losers and the real tough guys, right? And so in that case, they were looking at binge drinking, which could lead to addiction eventually, as a form of Zahavian signaling. So here's a very interesting application of a deep evolutionary biological principle to stuff that you would be interested in.
Yep, makes perfect sense to me. To me, as a biologist, it just immediately clicks. Like, makes perfect sense.
I actually loved how last time when we were chatting on your show, you said, I can't help but view everything through an evolutionary lens. I said, you know what? I'm going to really like this guy. I think we're developing a bromance because that's exactly how I live my life.
I, you know, when you're trained as a biologist, when I was deeply into my biological training, when I would ask a question, you know, why did this happen or what's happening here, I'd always put an evolutionary frame on it.
But it's more than your biologist training, because you could be a biologist completely steeped within proximate world, right?
I went to a liberal arts college.
I know, that's what you said last time, exactly. Yeah. Okay, let's take it a bit more personal, away from some of the medical stuff. You're both a well-respected physician, but also a very popular, media personality. If I put a gun to your head right now and said, you've got to walk away from one, you can only do the other, what's it going to be?
If you had asked me prior to 2010, it absolutely would have been media, no problem.
You would leave media or you would go to media?
Leave media. Okay. I would leave media, no problem. I was... For those years, I was sort of a reluctant media participant. I was like, I'll do this. I enjoy it. It's nice. It's interesting. I think I'm doing something good, but leave me alone to practice medicine. Leave me alone. You want to do a TV show? All right, I got Friday afternoon. Otherwise, forget it. I'm not going to do it. In 2010, I suddenly found myself doing a daytime talk show, an evening talk show, celebrity rehab, a nighttime radio show. And I looked in the mirror and said, okay, you are officially doing television now. Are you ready to kind of let some of the medicine go and start to focus on this and see if you can really make something out of it? And I sort of, it took me a few years to really accept that decision, but I'm there now. So now I have really shrunk down the medicine and I would let the medicine go, but I would lose a huge piece of not only who I am, but what I have to offer.
But what happened that you had that switch? Is it, let me give you an example. You might say, I'm tired of seeing despair and disease and misery. And yeah. as I move on later in my life, I don't want to see that. So what is the thing that caused the switch?
I think it was a multiplicity of factors. There was a switch, but there was things accumulating on both sides. I was getting older. I couldn't handle the swashbuckling quite so much. I had shrunk things down to be able to handle the media. And my identity was so tied up in being best physician I could possibly be that I could not have let that all go suddenly. But I let it go enough and tolerated the letting go that I could begin to contemplate letting it. I could now say contemplate letting it go all the way. And the other part had grown to the point, the media, that I was really enjoying it. It was fun. And it was literally like I'd said to myself, all right, you've done this part. You've done it. You don't have to keep doing it. Maybe there's something else you can do. And I like doing different things. I like creating. And so I sort of let the one take over and let the other one kind of fall back. But I couldn't, again, I couldn't do it fast. I had to learn to tolerate it because, again, my whole selfhood and my sense of purpose was very tied up in being the doctor.
I mean, the reason why I asked the question, because I can draw a very, very powerful personal analogy. Replace physician by professor, and now you have me facing exactly the same pulls that you are. Being a professor is in my DNA, yet as I get older, the slowness of academia is getting to me. I could get on a show, you know, with you or Jordan Peterson or whomever, and by nighttime I have 1.3 million people who have consumed this really valuable information, or I could be preparing the exam that takes me 6 hours, which will only reach 20 people. And I'm not denigrating it. Being a professor is part of who I am, but I think I'm getting to the point where I'm facing a similar kind of bifurcation as the one that you faced.
Yeah, and you strike me also as somebody that not only enjoys this process but enjoys creating, and that creative piece is what's getting scratched the most these days, and so here I am. I still don't let medicine go entirely because I just feel, first of all, the identity stuff is profound, but more importantly, I got to keep my hand in there just to hear and see and know what's going on. Otherwise I start to drift away completely, and things are, you got to be out there taking care of people to really understand what's going on.
Got you. Last question, Dr. Drew, because your wife warned me that you have a hard stop in about 8 minutes. So we'll do one more question and then we're gone. And of course we'll have you back again anytime you'd like to come back.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. So one of my former professors in psychology at Cornell, his name is Tom Gilovich. He wrote a fantastic paper, I think over 20 years ago now, where he looked at the psychology of regret, and specifically the regret of action versus the regret of inaction, right? I regret that I cheated on my wife versus I regret that I never pursued dancing. And it turns out, you may be surprised by this, that the greatest source of regret for most people is due to inaction, not to something I did, but something I didn't do. So let me turn it to you now. I'm your psychoanalyst. You're sitting on my couch. What is the greatest source of regret for Dr. Drew?
Well, it's funny. Back to this creative impulse. I would not have answered this. I'm very lucky that I don't have a lot of regrets. Everything's been as kind of a navigation, and I feel extremely privileged and grateful. I get to do interesting, creative things with no other goal than doing good. I mean, how much better does it get than that? It just doesn't. But in terms of regret, as I was lying there sick, this is really funny, with COVID, I was really out of my mind. And all I could do all day was sort of look at TikTok and just scroll through TikTok. And time would pass and I'd have no idea. And I have a musical part of me. I sung opera when I was a kid. I played piano when I was a kid. And I always think, not if only, because I was never that good. But it just, I regret that I can't do what I used to do. I regret not doing a little more with it. But here's the funny part. So as I was scrolling through TikTok, I became preoccupied with pianists that were posting stuff and tap dancers. And I went to one of the tap dancing companies, but I was like, God, I should have kept with piano. I really wish I kept piano, and I should get a pair of tap shoes. I think some of the tap thing was I was motorically, my motor system was off. from COVID, and I was thinking, I gotta do something to get my legs back under me, quite literally.
What?
So I have recently felt some profound regret on the musical front that if I should have kept playing the piano, I have a son that's a consummate piano player, and I envy what he's got.
So I'll end it on this note. It looks like we just psychoanalyzed the reason why you appeared on The Masked Singer.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's not – you don't have to figure that
Forget
out.
Forget about Dr. Freud. Talk about Dr. Sad.
Yeah, it was – I used to sing. I saw an opportunity to sing, and there's a whole story attached to that.
Nice.
Turns out I've got some pathology in my vocal cords, which is why I can't keep doing the things I used to do, and we had to rehab and adjust, and there was all kinds of stuff that went into that little performance on The Masked Singer. But you get a little depressed, you know, as you lose things that you have. It's almost like if you were an athlete and could do stuff before you can't do. It's a little depressing. You regret not having that anymore.
Dr. Drew, the hour flew too quickly. We'll have you back on again. What a pleasure to speak to you again. Thank you for coming, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. I insist we talk soon, and I insist I come back. And let's get deeper into the evolutionary biology next time.
I look forward to it. Cheers.